Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Now, KMOX at your service. Welcome to Nothing Impossible, sponsored by BioSTL, driving the St. Louis innovation economy. Now, Nothing Impossible on KMOX.
Welcome in, Michael Calhoun and Travis Sheridan with you on our show where we converse about local innovation. And we're going to take you to the Magic House, first of all, on the program today, as the Made Makerspace in the Del Mar Loop opens up again. It's a great place for kids to go and learn about STEM careers, learn how to build things, maybe not use the water jet until they're of a certain age, Travis Sheridan.
Yeah, well, it's called Made for Kids, and it's their entree into the maker movement.
Yeah, really cool space. We've been to the Made Maker space, done a whole show from there. Just love all the stuff. You've certainly made some cool stuff using these machines.
Space. Yeah, it's interesting. I often hear it referred to as the adult maker space, and I'm always wondering, like, what are people making in there? If it's an adult maker space, but I think it's all PG-13 at worst.
And then we're going to talk to Lashana Lewis, who's the executive director of the St. Louis Equity in Entrepreneurship Collective. They've been doing a kind of an audit of how equitable access is to support organizations, to investment for startups and small business owners in the St. Louis area. Entrepreneurship is a huge gateway for folks, and we got to make sure that everybody's got the same and fair access to the resources.
Absolutely. And coming out of or in the midst of this COVID pandemic, there are a number of people that are probably, maybe we'll call them reluctantly entrepreneurial or forced into entrepreneurship due to downsizing and layoffs. And so we want to make sure that there are resources available, not just for those that want to follow a dream, but are pursuing something out of necessity.
And the Equity and Entrepreneurship Collective grew out of BioSTL. And speaking of people reinventing themselves, our next segment is going to be with Confluence Discovery Technologies. They've researched a possible treatment for COVID-19. And a lot of the scientists at Confluence used to work for, let's say, a big multinational drug company with a research campus in West St. Louis County until there were layoffs. And they thought, what are we going to do? Well, we were doing this research. Why don't we just start our own company and continue the research? And that's how this company, Confluence Discovery Technologies, came about, and also how they wound up working on this drug, which now they believe could be used to treat COVID patients.
Again, another example of maybe not entrepreneurship by choice, but entrepreneurship out of necessity, and look at the impact that they could have.
Yeah. So we've got a lot coming up on this edition of the show. Stay tuned. We'll get right into it next with the Magic House. BioSTL presents Nothing Impossible on KMOX.
Welcome back to Nothing Impossible, sponsored by BioSTL, driving the St. Louis innovation economy on KMOX.
Welcome back. Michael Calhoun and Travis Sheridan with you on our weekly innovation conversation. And let's take you to the Del Mar Loop and to Kirkwood and get the latest on a place where local kids can really learn about STEM careers and entrepreneurialism. Carrie Hutchcraft from the Magic House is with us. Thank you so much, Carrie.
Thank you for having me on.
Carrie, tell us about what the Magic House experience is like in the Made STL location.
Certainly. So we actually opened the Magic House Made for Kids. So sometimes we'll call it just Made for Kids, almost a year ago, exactly. And so for those of you that are familiar with the downstairs adult makerspace Made, we are sort of an extension. But if you think of it in the sense of instead of extending over the age of those visitors, we're kind of going down to those younger visitors. And so Made stands for makers, artists, designers, and entrepreneurs. And we really are highlighting those four areas in our makerspace upstairs at that location.
So we've done the tour of the Made space and tech shop before that, and all of the really cool, also somewhat dangerous, but really cool equipment that they've got downstairs. How is the upstairs space different? Is it still where people can go to build physical products and create things?
Yes. So we are basically taking, you know, we're inspired by what's downstairs, and we have a lot of those same experiences, but we have them in a much safer space. So our facility was designed really with children ages 4 to 14 in mind. And so they can do a lot of the same things. So we have a 3D printer, and they have the ability to do some coding that they can then print on our printer. We have laser cutting with a different kind of laser cutter that lends itself to be a little bit more friendly for our young visitors that are using the space. We have everything from game design and stop motion animation. So really some of the things that you'll see downstairs on the lower level, but again, with that younger visitor in mind. But all things from, you know, letting that creativity go wild. So we have the areas that we have broken up is we have our maker space. We have an artist studio, which has everything from daily clay play with the ability to fire your clay creation in our kiln, to a digital painting easel without paint, actually. We also have our design lab, and that's where you can do the 3D printing. You can build and create a rocket. And then we have that entrepreneur thread throughout there as well. So it's definitely a younger experience than you'll find downstairs, but also aged up a little bit from what you might find in our Kirkwood location.
Hey, Carrie, a lot of the things that you are mentioning, if I reflect back on my grade school, middle school, and high school experience, a lot of those tools and activities, some of that vocational hands-on training was available in school systems. But I mean, a lot of that has gone by the wayside. Is this?
Right.
Are you seeing this as a nice opportunity to introduce kids to a whole new career field that might not be available to them through their traditional educational system?
Most certainly. And so I think that's what's really exciting about this space is that we do know that, you know, schools have changed. And while we're seeing, you know, while there's definitely some interest in STEM and STEAM in particular, you know, and more growing programs in schools, there's also, you know, like you said, that missing piece of it sometimes. And so we want kids to come here and maybe get inspired by something that they created in our space. And then also maybe learn that downstairs is an opportunity for them to, you know, grow up, get into high school, and actually continue to make a career out of making and creating. And so I think it's just, you know, it's an exciting venture. It's fun for kids when they come, but it's really, our hope is that it also has a lasting impact in inspiring them as far as what they want to look into in the future.
How is this a step up, or in terms of, I guess, age brackets from the Magic House in Kirkwood to the Made for Kids space, and then maybe older teenager moves downstairs? How is this coordinated with the Magic House?
So, you know, at the Magic House, what we typically have found is that, you know, our sweet spot really is from toddler up until elementary school. But we found that for many of our local visitors that have come, you know, year over year to the Magic House, that by the time they hit that middle school age, sometimes they feel like they've kind of aged out of our experience in Kirkwood. There's certainly some fun things that they can do there, but it's kind of a perception that they think, okay, I'm too old for that now. And so this new location really expands upon our age reach, in that there are some things at the new location that really are designed for that older middle school age child. The kid that really wants to get deeper into a discipline, get to experience it a little bit more. And so we definitely have expanded our reach. And then, you know, I think from the very beginning when we partnered with Cortex, it was, you know, about also kind of creating this funnel that, okay, we're going to get them when they're kids and we're going to inspire them. We're going to get them excited about these features. And then eventually the hope is that they move downstairs to the adult maker space as a career or a hobby. And that we really do have kind of a flow of visitors from, you know, infant in the Kirkwood location all the way up to adulthood when they move down to MADE, the adult maker space.
You know, that continuum is really critical because we, you know, we talk to, if I think about either entrepreneurs or corporates that are looking for talent, oftentimes they know they have a talent need now, right? Mm-hmm. They might have vacant positions now, but we have an aging population, right? We have a number of baby boomers that are going to be retiring in the next few years. And so a lot of these folks know that they're going to have, you know, a bigger talent problem in 15 years. So it sounds like MADE for Kids is, you know, helping produce the talent that that we will need in a society.
Well, that's what we're really hoping. You know, we're hoping that we can inspire them now as children. And so when they are thinking about, you know, once they have that time where they get to pick the courses that they get to take in school, that, you know, something maybe sparks them now to have that interest, that they will continue to engage in that. I will say another sort of exciting piece that's come out of our location is when we moved to the location, which we're right off of Del Mar, we had made a decision to hire our high school, college age staff from the community, the surrounding community. And I think what's been really exciting to also see is a lot of new staff members that were new to our organization that were also introduced to a lot of this technology. And so even beyond those middle schoolers, we have some high school students that now know how to work a laser cutter and know how to work the 3D printer. And we're, you know, even though they're a little bit old for our regular target, we've been able to engage a lot of those new staff members in this as well.
Carrie, I wanted to ask a question because, you know, we're in the midst of COVID-19. People have been doing a lot less with their hands in physical places other than on their keyboard. Are the kids that visit MADE for Kids, do they learn skills that they can do at home to keep the making going in the midst of maybe some isolation?
Yes, that is really the way that we designed the space is that many of the things that we have there, we hope are also experiences that you take home. So for example, with our 3D printer, obviously we have the 3D printer and that's not something that most families have in their home, but the system that we use to have the child actually do the coding on the front end is something that's available to anyone with a web browser and internet. So we have things like that throughout the space so that kids that do get really excited about something can continue that experience at home, similar to the stop motion animation. It's a free app that we use and we tell people what that app is so that they can go home and continue that fun at home. We have, you know, for stop motion video, we have kind of sets and we have everything created so that, you know, they have all of the Lego tools and they have the backgrounds to really amp up that. But our hope is that they're continuing that fun when they go home and that, you know, while we'd love to see them come every day, we know that's not realistic, but if they were excited about it, we don't want to stop them from being able to continue that fun just because they're not at our facility.
Carrie, how is the access? You mentioned hiring, especially high school students from the surrounding community, but how is access for younger students in the surrounding school mm-hmm. districts? Travis mentioned they may not have these kinds of programs in their school. They may not go there on their free time. Are most of the visitors to MADE kids being brought by their parents on a mm-hmm. weekend, or are they organized school groups?
It's definitely a variety. So we were really fortunate to receive some wonderful funding from the Boeing company this past school year that helped provide free field trips for any school district in need. And so what that ensured is that there were no barriers for schools. And with us being in that location as well, for all of the St. Louis public schools, they had a really close drive to get to us, where while we've always offered free programming in our Kirkwood location, you know, the bus ride to Kirkwood is definitely a longer trip. And so, you know, it was a combination. We also had an amazing partnership with the St. Louis Public Library, where you could rent a pass to MADE for Kids just using your library card. So we really lowered any barriers possible to make sure that any family, regardless of their income, still had access to be able to come and visit. So obviously with COVID, things are on a little bit of a hold, but we are really excited and anxious to be able to bring field trip programming back in the fall, if that is allowed, as well as to reopen our library partnership again, because we want to make sure that, you know, every family that wants to come has the opportunity. When we set up the pricing structure, we really, you know, set that up in mind with making sure that even the price alone, if you were going to pay the full rate, was not a determining factor. So admission there is just $5 per person. It is a subsidized rate from what the actual cost of coming for a visit would be. But we wanted to make sure that that was available for families that didn't even feel like they had to ask for free admission, that they really felt like if they wanted to come, in addition to the free opportunities that might be available, they would have that. And we also have very affordable membership rates, which are $50 per year. That's unlimited access for your family to come as many times as you want.
So let's talk, as we're wrapping up here, we only have a couple more moments, but as we're looking at reopening, what does that look like? What does Made for Kids look like in a, I won't call it a post-COVID world, I know it's not gone yet, but in a COVID-impacted world?
Yeah. So we have definitely changed some of our procedures. Most notably is that we have limited capacity. So we are only opening capacity at the moment at just 25% of our traditional capacity there. So that when you come, there's far few families in the facility, and they're able to spread apart into kind of family unit areas without access to other families. So that's definitely a big piece of it. We did also change to have registration in advance to help us control the attendance numbers and make sure that we are able to, you know, control how many people are coming in the building. So those are two big determining, big changes that we've made. Some other things that we've done is actually create individual kits of activity supplies. So traditionally, when you come in, you have access to, let's say, markers, crayons, pencils that are shared between visitors. Right now, you're going to get a bag that has a bunch of goodies that are just for you. So if you don't want to share a supply with somebody else, you want to make sure that you're the only one that's touched your scissors. It's a single use kind of access to make sure that there's no cross contamination. And of course, our staff is out there in full force, wiping, cleaning, encouraging hand sanitizer, and really, you know, going, doing all that they can to make sure that everyone is confident and enjoying their time in a safe way.
And you can get more information at magichouse.org. I understand you can make reservations at magichouse.org/reservations.
Exactly.
Carrie Hutchcraft of the Magic House and Made for Kids, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk with you.
We'll be back with more Nothing Impossible. Stick around right after this.
Welcome back to Nothing Impossible, sponsored by BioSTL, driving the St. Louis innovation economy on KMOX.
Welcome back to Nothing Impossible, Travis Sheridan and Michael Calhoun, and we are joined by LaShawna Lewis. She is the Executive Director in St. Louis Equity and Entrepreneurship Collective. Thanks for joining us, LaShawna.
Hey, folks. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So, first of all, what is this collective?
Basically, it is a group, a bunch of ESOs, and I'll try to stop throwing in a bunch of acronyms there because I worked in corporate America, so I know it's like acronyms are everywhere. ESOs are entrepreneurial support organizations. So basically, the organizations you go to when you're starting your company for the first time to kind of help you get your footings and bearings and navigate your way around your startup. So basically, a bunch of those, as well as entrepreneurs and investors. You're thinking the VCs and all of that good stuff, family foundations, et cetera, decided to get together and address the problem with what racial equity and gender parity in the entrepreneurial realm in the St. Louis region. So basically, we've been in existence since 2016 through a fabulous grant through the Kauffman Foundation and through help with BioSTL, who kind of had the brainchild to even get the group of people together. This is the very first time that the collective has decided to hire staff. I told them, you know, I've got some crazy ideas that'll move us forward, and they're in for the ride. So, so that's pretty much what we are and kind of how we're starting off now in 2020.
So before you look ahead at what you can do, how do you evaluate the situation in St. Louis for startup founders and whether there is equitable access to all of those resources out there? How do you evaluate where we stand?
Oh, no, that's a good question. For the most part, we kind of got together, had a summit in 2016, asked a lot of questions. It was like a half day. Everybody's eating lunch and trying to delve straight into everything. So instead of it just being data and getting surveys and things like that, it was like, let's all sit down and talk. Real talk, what is going on and what's keeping people from getting what they need to be successful in their entrepreneurial endeavors, especially within those two demographics I mentioned with women and people of color. So after that was housed, an independent party did come in and actually do a little bit more investigation, tried to dig a little bit more into the data aspect of it. And then kind of on a regular basis, we're going out, we're talking to the community, we're having convenings, we're presenting more information and material, getting a lot more feedback. And it's kind of this collaborative effort as opposed to this top-down, heavy kind of authoritarian model where you got to get all the stuff done that we think that you need to get done. So it's a lot more back and forth between us and the community that we're serving.
And so when you talk about that study, what results came out of that?
For the most part, it's, I like to say, a common sense. A lot of women and people of color who start businesses, they don't have a safety net. A lot of businesses that do tend to make those mistakes, pivot, do all these other sorts of things. And we've seen it in different companies that have come out of Silicon Valley, where maybe they started off doing one particular product and then they pivoted and then they became a different type of product. But they still had that chance to stumble and fall. But unfortunately, especially with women and with people of color who start businesses, when they stumble and fall, they may not have a friends and family round to help them out again, or they don't have, you know, some backup fund that'll just give them a second chance. So a lot of that is kind of the impetus of where we're starting. But as well as sometimes they can't even get into some of these, you know, great accelerators and things of that nature to even know how to formulate things for their own businesses. So it's a combination of getting the resources to these entrepreneurs as well as trying to get the capital to them.
LaShawna, you know, we hear oftentimes, and this probably comes out of Silicon Valley the most, you know, this idea of celebrate failure, right?
Right.
But wouldn't you have, I mean, just to say that, there has to be an amazing, you have to have an amazing amount of privilege to be able to say that you're going to celebrate failure, because you have that safety net, whether it's venture capitalists or, you know, rich parents or whatever it might be. But you alluded to the fact that, you know, a lot of Black and Brown entrepreneurs, a lot of women don't have that same safety net. So how is this collective helping them, not necessarily, you know, we don't want to celebrate failures, but mitigate those failures or look for a way to be strong so that they may not have the same types of failures?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I'll say that I'm an entrepreneur myself. I actually have a company called Ellen Lewis Consulting. And what I do is diversity consulting. I'll just say that when I started in 2018, I didn't get as much fervor. So there wasn't a lot of money coming in. A lot of people were very kind of tiptoey. But one of the things I faced personally as a woman of color, as a queer person that's out, is that, you know, people are kind of skeptical and they don't know if they want to kind of get help from me, or that I might kind of go too hard with giving too much of the help. And one of the things I had to get over personally was that, you know, if people need this help, I need to be out there and I need to not be afraid of what they think about me. And as I start to talk to more women, more Black and Brown people, more queer people who are starting businesses, I tell people all of this is a two-way street. You know, yes, we got to get them the resources and the capital and et cetera, but at the same time, we kind of build up their mojo and say, look, you know, you can do this. This is something that people need, and you're going to run into those, you know, jerks that are going to tell you the opposite, but you have to kind of have confidence in yourself that you develop this idea because you knew there was a need. And just because you may not see that onslaught of people right away. As with my diversity consulting, in the last week, my calendar just started filling up. I knew that it was a need that needed to be met, and maybe the market wasn't necessarily aware enough of me, but that doesn't mean that your business doesn't need to exist.
You know, we hear a lot about the venture capital community, and there are folks like Arlen Hamilton, who I know that you know really well, mm-hmm. Who is a successful venture capitalist with Backstage Capital. What's the capital landscape look like for people of color, Black entrepreneurs, Brown entrepreneurs? What's that look like these days?
Interestingly enough, I actually was just in a webinar yesterday with Black and Brown VCs. And one of the things that I thought was really instrumental that they were saying is that there's this myth or belief that there aren't enough Black and Brown accredited investors. The times have changed drastically within the last 5 to 10 years, and there are plenty of people who are accredited investors. And those are people who individually make $200,000, I believe, a year, and or $300,000 as a couple. So if that is kind of the bar for making that amount of money and having an investor be able to actually give something meaningful to a company, there's quite a few Black and Brown people out there that could come together and do things like a venture capital firm, like what you see Arlen doing. And now they're kind of starting to get into traditional venture capitalist firms, because now those firms are starting to see that they're missing a whole entire scope of people who are out there that they could invest in. And the recent Black Lives Matter movement has really made a dent in that and said, hey, we're out here. You know, we're not your 1950s idea of what Black and Brown people are. We are progressive. We have these ideas. We want to move forward. We need you to move forward with us. So for the most part, the venture capitalist firms are just starting to kind of wake up to that. but as many Black and Brown people, including myself, are doing, we have this cautious optimism that we're kind of waiting to see exactly what's going to happen and how the needle's going to move.
Have there been some tough conversations with investors and support organizations in the St. Louis area? You know, bring them some details from the equity audit and say, you could be doing better. Have there been conversations like that with St. Louis groups?
Yes. Out of respect, I'm not going to give the name of the person who told me this, but I will say that it's a white woman, and she said that she talked to other investors and they're not ready for the conversation. A lot of them are having a very, very hard time. I didn't ask for details, but I completely believe it. This is a very, very difficult conversation when you're used to doing things like pattern matching for white nerdy males whenever you invest. Then, you know, now you're telling the investor, okay, you can't look at that anymore because that's not the future. I even tried to tell people, what does your customer base look like? If it's not white, nerdy male anymore and it's starting to diversify, then you need to think differently about the people that you have on your team and who they're targeting, because you're going to be out of business or people are not really going to look at you anymore as a solid investor or somebody that is open enough to an idea or an opportunity. So those conversations are happening, and they are really hard right now.
We're talking with LaShawna Lewis. She's the executive director of the St. Louis Equity and Entrepreneurship Collective. It's an organization that is supported partially by a large extent by the Kauffman Foundation, and is also connected to BioSTL. LaShawna, you know, what does success look like? You know, this collective has been around for a couple of years now. Take us into the future. What does success look like?
To me, success looks like everybody pretty much being able to be on the same playing field. The problem that we have is that we have specialized playing fields for specialized areas. And then, you know, words like niche, a product and things like that, that are too convoluted and too muddying the waters as far as what a company looks like, as far as like their success rates, as far as the audiences that they're targeting, as far as basically the type of investors and the background that they have. It's all just kind of categorized and separated out. And once we get rid of some of these categories, once everyone can kind of compete on this level playing field, and not have to go to one area or another area just to be successful, then to me, that's what success looks like. A lot of people say, you know, oh, the black and brown people, they just want charity. So yeah, I'm happy to throw a few bucks over to your for-profit or whatever, or your entrepreneurial endeavor. And it's like, no, I don't want that. I just want the same equal chance of the white nerdy male component too. So if you're asking them to do a friends and family round, and you know that's not something that everybody can do, I want that eliminated. I want that taken out, because then it's ridiculous. It's not putting everybody on the same ground. If you're just like, everybody gets $100,000, do the best that you can with it. If you mess up, there's a backup. Let's evaluate. Let's see what went wrong and see if you're still interested in doing that endeavor, and we'll definitely be interested in you. Then that's the kind of model that I would personally like to see. But again, this is about people sitting in a room talking and figuring all of this out. And so part of me is a little skeptical, you know, will this happen? But to me, in the future, that's what I want to see, is that, you know, as I believe her name was Kim Jones so eloquently put it, you know, the thing that we're not asking for is revenge. We're asking for equality. So to me, that is what that future would look like, equality in all of its realms.
Well, LaShawna, if people wanted to get more involved in the Equity and Entrepreneurship Collective here in St. Louis, or just learn more about it, where can they go?
We have a website that we just kind of freshly updated, stlequitycollective.org, and it's exactly the way that it sounds. You can also email me at info@stlequitycollective.org. And myself, and I actually have a staff member that works under me, Haley Johnston, who's actually been kind of baked into the entrepreneurial sector for some years as well. We both are heading up the collective, and one of us will get back to you.
Great. LaShawna Lewis, the executive director of the St. Louis Equity and Entrepreneurship Collective. Thank you so much for joining us.
Awesome. Thank you, guys.
And we'll be back with more Nothing Impossible right after this.
Welcome back to Nothing Impossible, sponsored by BioSTL, driving the St. Louis innovation economy on KMOX.
All right, let's check out Michael's interview with Joe Monahan. He's a scientist with Confluence Discovery Technologies.
So Joe, tell us about this treatment you've come up with for COVID-19 patients, a little bit of background on the disease itself, and then where you think you can intervene.
So COVID-19 is an acute respiratory disease caused by the novel coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2. And this disease can progress, particularly in those predisposed individuals, to pneumonia and a condition called acute respiratory distress syndrome. And when you get this acute respiratory distress syndrome, subset of those folks require mechanical ventilation, and they progress, a subset of those progress to death. Progression in this acute respiratory distress syndrome is thought to be a result of a hyperactive immune response to the viral infection. And this leads to an uncontrolled inflammatory state in the lungs. And this is driven in large part by a certain class of proteins released from immune cells and diseased tissues called cytokines. And this excessive pro-inflammatory cytokine production is called cytokine storm, or cytokine release syndrome. So our hypothesis is that if you can block this cytokine storm, you'll prevent progression of the disease, reverse the acute respiratory distress syndrome in the lung, and reduce the need for ventilation and reduce mortality in these patients. And so what our drug, ATI-450, does is it blocks a particular cellular pathway that's responsible for making several of these key proteins or cytokines, thereby reducing the concentration of these cytokines in the lung, and that would have a concomitant effect on reducing the inflammation and decreasing the acute respiratory distress syndrome that's present.
How is this drug delivered to the patient?
This is an oral drug that would be given twice a day.
So inflammation is at the heart of this, and this is something you were looking at well before COVID. In fact, it was one of the cornerstones of founding Confluence Discovery Technologies. What are some of the other ailments that could be affected by this?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think with inflammation, over the past 10 years, it's been a growing field suggesting that inflammation underlies many diseases, not just diseases of the immune system. And so when we're developing ATI-450, we had this broad impact on a lot of these particular proteins that regulate a number of different tissues. And so other diseases that we're looking at rheumatoid arthritis. This would have potential in diseases such as COPD, potentially in inflammatory bowel disease, potentially in heart disease, where there's an inflammatory component of the heart disease. And then there's a bunch of smaller indications that are more personalized and orphan indications that we could potentially use this in as well.
So this has already been tested for safety and tolerability in people. That happened last year. What is the timeline from going to get approval for human studies to actually doing the studies, and then how long do they take? I guess when will people be able to access this?
Yeah, so we would be moving in, particularly with, for instance, with this COVID-19 study. We'll begin the study in the upcoming days, and that will be a phase 2 study. And with that study, we'll be able to get an understanding in a subset of patients whether or not this has efficacy sufficient to move forward into a bigger group of patients. So we're in a phase 2A study, it's called. We would then move to a bigger set of patients in a phase 2B study, and then move into an even larger set in a phase 3 study. In that, the treatment for COVID-19 is a reasonably short treatment in comparison to other diseases such as heart disease, where this treatment is only a 2-week treatment. You can move through these studies reasonably quickly, although as you get larger and larger as far as the study size, it would take longer. Generally speaking, going from where we are now in a phase 2A to on the market and for people to access, generally talking about 3 to 6 years.
So we've got arthritis use versus COVID use, and those may have a different speeds for approval.
It would be a separate track for each treatment to get approved. The 3 to 6 years is more like the arthritis treatment. I think with COVID-19, there's expedited paths that one can take that's supported by the FDA that can shorten that timeline. So if this disease continues to progress and we have, you know, flares we don't get a treatment or a vaccine in short order, or there's another disease like COVID-19, which would be another respiratory virus, this could be expedited to be shorter than that time frame.
Now, as you do this research into the pandemic, we are in the middle of a pandemic. A lot of places are taking precautions. A lot of places are working from home. You're located in the BioSTL building. What's it been like working there?
Yes, I think different companies had different approaches. In our situation, we were exempt, and so we were allowed to continue to work. Having said that, we have about 45 scientists in Confluence in St. Louis, and we took a number of precautions, which included moving to shift work, moving to working 7 days a week to decrease the number of people that are on site at any one time. We went into social distancing. Everyone had appropriate PPEs with masks, et cetera. We did continue to do the work in that we are developing this drug and other key drugs that we felt like it was important for us to continue. And knock on wood, to date, everybody's been safe.
And how has the St. Louis ecosystem enabled your work? You grew out of BioGenerator. You're still located, even after your exit, still located in the BioSTL building. What is it about being located in St. Louis that helped to fuel your research?
Yeah, when we first started the company back in 2010, working with the BioGenerator with Charlie Boltman, Eric Golvi was instrumental in us getting started. It wouldn't have happened without them. And then when we came up with the idea of this biogenerator accelerator lab that allowed a number of companies to move into a particular lab space and not have to spend their funding on finding equipment and lab space, that again allowed us to progress. And so we were the first people in the biogenerator accelerator labs. We stayed in there for a number of years. We're still down in the Cortex Bioscience District. We moved into the old Crescent building. We have our own space, but we're on just a floor above where the biogenerator and BioSTL are. So we have the fourth floor in that building. Still a lot of interactions between us and the various companies within BioSTL and the biogenerator, and we still work very closely with them. So without the ecosystem and the support of BioSTL, the biogenerator, WashU, et cetera, we wouldn't have been able to create what we created, to be able to maintain the core of scientists that came out of Pfizer and would have been distributed across the country and have them remain in St. Louis. Out of the 45 people, we have about 28 that are ex-Pfizer scientists with a lot of experience in drug discovery. We were able to keep them here because of the support that we got from BioGenerate and BioSTL.
You know, a lot of times people see a story about major layoffs at a big local company and they think, well, there's more bad news. But this is an example of how that could be, there could be a silver lining to those kinds of situations. People are enabled to go out and start their own companies and follow their dreams.
I think that's right. I think when we, you know, we had the opportunity to stay with Pfizer and move to Cambridge and, but we had some ideas about trying to do drug discovery a little bit differently than what we were able to do with Pfizer being a big company. And we just made the decision that we thought we could do something different, try something that might end up being better. And we took the shot. We had a lot of support at the time. You know, it looks like it's starting to pan out. We have this compound in clinical development. We have a second compound or a different mechanism that'll be in clinical development in people within the next 3 or 4 months, and then another one that will be in people early next year. So all coming out of what we worked that we did between, you know, 2010 and 2017 and 18.
Well, thanks for your time, Joe.
It's my pleasure. I appreciate the call.
That's Joe Monahan with Confluence Discovery Technologies.
All right, so that's our show for the week. We talked magic, we talked equity, we talked solving COVID. It's a lot.
A lot of important conversations.
Yeah, we have them here.
And we'll have them next week. Stay tuned. It's Nothing Impossible, presented by BioSTL on KMOX.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with autopay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without autopay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.